I want to start with a vibe check. You know that feeling when you walk out of the office on a Friday or when you finally move into your own apartment and you close the door.
Yes.
There's this rush. You think, okay, I'm in charge now. I can eat cereal for dinner. I can sleep until noon.
Nobody can touch me.
Nobody can touch me.
Yeah.
We call that autonomy.
It's a powerful feeling. It's probably, I mean, it's the primary driver for most of modern Western life, I'd say.
Exactly. It's the
Yeah.
bumper sticker, right? Don't tread on me. Personal sovereignty, it feels visceral. It feels, political.
It does.
But I've been buried in the source material for this deep dive all week, reading through Aristotle, John Locke, some really dense systems theory, and I realized something a little uncomfortable. I
Oh.
realized I've been using the word wrong, or at least I've been using it shallowly.
Well, most of us do. We confuse the sensation of freedom with the structure of freedom, and those are two very different things.
Right. And that's the mission today. We aren't here to talk about the political vibe of liberty. We're here to strip this concept down to the studs. The sources we have today treat autonomy not as a slogan, but as an engineering problem.
Yeah.
Like if you were building an AI or designing a constitution.
Or just trying to understand your own brain.
Yes.
Yes.
What is the actual architecture required to run the program called freedom?
And it is an architecture. It's not just a blank space where you get to do what you want. The source material, it breaks it down into three distinct, let's call them operating systems.
Okay.
You have the philosophical definition, the social definition, and then the practical definition.
And the kicker is that these three systems, they don't always get along. They actually crash into each other constantly.
They do. So if we want to really understand this, we have to look at them one by one. We have to start with the foundation.
We have to go back to
You
Athens.
have to look at Aristotle.
Okay, so let's start with the word itself. Etymology is always the best cheat code. Autonomy. It comes from autonomous.
Which translates literally to self-law or self-rule.
Which sounds simple enough. I make my own rules.
Yeah.
But Aristotle positions this in a way that I found really, well, counterintuitive. He doesn't just define freedom as doing whatever.
Yeah.
He maps existence on a spectrum. And to understand what autonomy is, you first have to understand the two things it isn't.
Right. So think of a line on the far left extreme, you have what Aristotle calls slavery.
And we need to be precise here.
Very. He's not just talking about the historical atrocity of chattel slavery, though that obviously fits. He's defining a functional state of being.
So in this context, slavery is an algorithm.
It's an algorithm, exactly. It's a state where the rules, the purpose, the destination, it's all provided by an external agent.
You're just a script runner.
That's a great way to put it. Someone else writes the code, you just execute the binary. There's no self involved in the direction of the ship. You're purely an instrument of another will.
Okay, that tracks. If I'm just a tool for someone else, I am not autonomous. That's extreme A. But let's swing to the other side of the spectrum. Extreme B. If extreme A is all rules come from outside, your instinct is to say the opposite
The
is true.
rules at all.
No rules at all, total uninhibited movement.
Yeah.
And that feels like the ultimate freedom, doesn't it? I mean,
Yeah.
if I'm floating in a void doing whatever random thing pops into my head, zero constraints, zero gravity, zero bosses,
Yeah.
am I not the most free being in the universe?
Aristotle would say absolutely not. He calls that state randomness.
Randomness.
And he argues quite aggressively that randomness is not autonomy.
This is the part I had to read twice. Why isn't chaos the ultimate freedom?
Because there's no self in chaos. Think about a leaf blowing in a hurricane.
Okay.
It's moving faster and more erratically than anything else in the sky. It has no boss. It has no schedule, no job description. But is it free?
No, it's just reacting. It's a victim of physics.
Precisely. It's just noise. If your actions have no why, if there's no governing structure or teleology behind them, you aren't an agent. You're just an event happening in the world.
So Aristotle hands us this paradox. To be free, you have to avoid slavery, so you can't accept rules from others. But to be free, you also have to avoid randomness, so you must have rules.
You need a rudder. You can't just drift.
You need a rudder.
The sweet spot of autonomy is right there in the middle. It isn't the absence of constraints, it is the presence of self-imposed constraints. You have to write your own operating manual.
Right.
If you aren't following a manual, you're drifting in chaos. If you're following someone else's, you're a slave. Autonomy is the hard, rigorous work of legislating your own existence.
I love that phrasing, legislating your own existence. It implies freedom is an active job, It's not a vacation.
Not at all.
You are the governor of your own internal state.
Mm.
You decide what you want, but more importantly, you decide what you don't want. You set the boundaries.
That's the internal engine. That's the Aristotelian self-rule. And if we all lived on individual islands, we could stop the deep dive right here.
But we don't. We live in crowded cities with 8 billion other people who are also trying to be their own governors.
And that brings us to the second layer, the social definition. Hmm. This is where we bring in John Locke.
So Aristotle is single-player mode. Locke is multiplayer mode.
Correct. Locke's problem is, how do I rule myself without destroying your ability to rule yourself?
Okay.
The source material creates a very specific boundary condition here. It says freedom under Locke means you can do whatever you want up until a specific point.
The point of interference.
It's a collision model. You are free to act until your action interferes with the freedom of another person to execute their self-rule.
It sounds simple on paper. Your liberty ends where my nose begins.
Mm.
But the source uses a really specific case study to show how complicated this gets.
The alcohol scenario.
The alcohol scenario.
Right. The drinking versus driving dilemma. This is a classic example for a reason.
Let's walk through it. Under the Lockean definition, let's look at the action of drinking alcohol.
In isolation, say you're sitting in your living room with the curtains drawn, you have total liberty here.
Mm-hmm.
You can drink a vintage wine, cheap beer. You can drink until you pass out.
Because the only person affecting the self-rule is me. My liver, my headache, my bad morning. I am the legislator and the victim.
Exactly. That is your personal sphere of influence. However, the definition changes the moment you combine that action with a high-velocity machine and enter a public road.
Right.
The source specifically flags the transition from just drinking to driving while intoxicated.
Now, let's play devil's advocate for a second. Why does the definition break there? Is it just because society thinks drunk driving is bad?
It's more structural than just bad. It's about probability and, well, physics. When you get behind the wheel of a car while intoxicated, you are drastically increasing the probability of a physical collision.
I see.
And a collision is the ultimate violation of Locke's autonomy.
Because if I crash into you, I am forcefully removing your ability to execute your plans.
Yes. If you are driving to work or driving to pick up your kids and I smash into you, my exercise of freedom, my drunken joyride, has just deleted your freedom.
Wow.
I have become the external force imposing a massive constraint on you. I've become the slavery aspect of your spectrum. My chaos has dictated your reality.
So social autonomy is defined by the fact of others. It's a negotiation. I can do what I want, but only if what I want doesn't stop you from doing what you want.
It's a liberty constraint. Freedom in a social setting isn't infinite space. It's bounded by the existence of other agents.
So we've got layer one. Aristotle saying, make your own rules or you're just chaos.
Mm-hmm.
We've got layer two, Locke saying, don't crash into people or you're a tyrant.
Both of those are theoretical. They are frameworks for how we should act. But the source moves on to a third definition, which I found the most fascinating because it stops being philosophy and starts being mechanics.
And the practical definition.
I like to call it the implementation stack.
Yeah, this really stood out to me. It's presented as a tripartite system, three layers of hardware that have to sit on top of each other.
And if you remove one layer, the whole thing collapses. Doesn't matter what Aristotle or Locke say, if you don't have this stack, you aren't free.
It's like a diagnostic tool.
Exactly. If you want to know if an agent, a person, a robot, a citizen is actually free, don't ask them how they feel. Check these three boxes. The first layer is the most basic. Physical freedom.
Unboundedness.
Right. Are you physically restrained? Are you in handcuffs? Are you locked in a cell? If your hardware is physically unable to move, you cannot be autonomous. That's baseline.
The source uses a graphic here that I want to dwell on. A sunflower.
The sunflower. It's a perfect example of why physical freedom is a trap if you stop there.
So the image shows a sunflower turning to face the sun. As the sun moves, the flower rotates.
Mm.
The source calls this a kind of physical freedom. It's unbounded. It's not tied down in a way that prevents that movement.
Yeah. It is physically free to optimize its position. But the source argues that for humans, sunflower freedom is insufficient. In fact, it's arguably not freedom at all.
Because the sunflower is just reacting to a stimulus, right? It looks at the sun because it has to. It's hard-coded.
It's biological mechanics. It's unbounded, but it's not autonomous in the Aristotelian sense. It's not self-legislating, it's sun-legislating.
Huh, sun-legislating. I like that.
The sun moves, the flower moves. It has no choice to look away. For a human, Physical unboundedness is necessary. You can't be free if you're in prison, but it's not the whole picture. You need the next layer up.
Layer two, informational freedom.
This is where we get into the epistemology of freedom. And honestly, this is the one most people overlook in the modern world.
How so?
You cannot act freely if you do not know the parameters of the world.
The source gives a great example here, giving an online seminar.
Oh, this is the nightmare scenario.
Okay, so imagine this. You're physically free. You're sitting in your chair. Laptop's there. Internet is perfect. You have sunflower freedom. Nobody's holding your mouth shut. You are ready to present.
You don't know the topic.
You have to give a one-hour keynote speech right now to 1,000 people. But nobody will tell you if it's about astrophysics, 18th century poetry, or plumbing.
Are you free to give that speech?
Technically, yes. My vocal cords work. I can make sounds.
But meaningfully? No, you're paralyzed. Without the information, the context, the expectations, the subject matter, your actions are random.
I'm back to being the leaf in the wind.
You're the leaf in the wind. You might start talking about plumbing and the conference is on poetry. Your action has no relation to the reality around you.
That's such a powerful distinction. Ignorance is a form of constraint.
It is.
If you hide the data from me, you are limiting my autonomy just as effectively as if you handcuffed me.
It's actually more effective than handcuffs, because if you're in handcuffs, you know you're not free, you feel the metal. If you're just missing information, or if you're being fed propaganda, you might think you're free. You might think you're making a choice, but you're making it based on a false map of reality. Informational freedom is access to the true data required to make a valid decision.
Okay, so I'm physically loose, that's layer one, I have the data layer two. But the stack has one final hurdle.
Layer three. Psychological or intentional freedom.
The processor.
Physically. You can have the data and you can be unbound, but if your mind is infused with interference, you aren't free. The source specifically mentions things like severe intoxication, psychosis, or even extreme cognitive coercion.
So it's the capacity to process.
Correct. Informational freedom is having the data. Psychological freedom is the capacity to make sense of that data. It's the ability to maintain common sense, as the source puts it.
So going back to the seminar example, if I have the topic, I know it's about poetry.
Informational freedom, check.
And I have the laptop.
Physical freedom, check.
But I've just taken a massive dose of hallucinogens, and I think the laptop is a dragon.
You are not autonomous. You might have the inputs, but the processing unit is glitching. You can't turn that input into self-legislated action. You're reacting to the dragon, not the reality. You've lost the ability to legislate yourself.
So the full practical definition requires all three to be greenlit. I need to be physically unconstrained. I need to be informationally aware. And I need to be psychologically competent.
It's a dependency chain. If you break the psychological link, the information is useless. If you break the information link, the physical freedom is aimless. And if you break the physical link, well, the other two are just thoughts in a cage.
This is a lot more rigorous than I expected. We started with a bumper sticker and we ended up with a systems diagram.
That's the beauty of it.
So let's zoom out and try to synthesize this. We experience freedom as a feeling wind in the hair, nobody tell me what to do. But technically, based on this deep dive, it's what? One, self-legislation, non-interference. And three, a functioning stack of physical, informational, and cognitive capacities.
It connects the internal world, the social world, and the biological world. All three have to work.
But here is where it gets really complicated for me. And I want to pose this to you. Because when I look at these three definitions, they don't play nice together.
Yeah.
They actually seem to be at war.
They are constantly in tension. That's the catch.
Let's look at the clash between Locke and Aristotle. Aristotle says, I need to give a rule to myself to be free. Locke says, I need to limit my action to ensure I don't hit you.
Yes, and society is essentially the referee of that clash.
So, okay, let's take the drunk driving example again. Society, the collective other, creates a rule. Do not drive drunk.
That is a locking rule. It's a rule designed for social safety to prevent collisions.
Exactly. But that is an external rule. That's a rule coming from the outside, from the state. If I obey that rule purely because the police will arrest me if I don't, am I in slavery mode, according to Aristotle?
That is the profound philosophical tension. If the rule is imposed entirely from the outside, then strictly speaking, you are following an external determination. You're safe. You're a good citizen. You are protecting your neighbor. But are you autonomous?
Because I didn't write the code.
Yeah.
I'm just executing it to avoid punishment.
Right. Ideally, you would internalize that rule. You would say, I choose not to drive drunk because I value life, then it becomes Aristotelian.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just obey because you're scared of the ticket, that's not freedom. That's compliance.
And this gets even stickier and, frankly, more dangerous when we look at the informational layer.
Yeah.
Think about how governments handle safety.
Okay.
To keep society safe, to satisfy Locke, sometimes we restrict information.
Mm.
We classify documents. We hide dangerous data about how to build weapons. Or we suppress sensitive political realities because we think they might cause riots.
We limit informational freedom to preserve social autonomy.
Exactly. We say you can't handle this data. If you have this data, you might cause a collision.
And that is the slippery slope. Because remember, if I limit your information, I am limiting your ability to be a free agent.
Right.
I am making you sunflower free. You can move around, but you don't know the truth, so you can't make a real choice.
So here's the question I'm left wrestling with. We want to believe we can have it all, Aristotle's self-rule, Locke's social harmony, and the full practical stack. But in the real world, it feels like a zero-sum game. At what point does the rule we create for social safety start being a tool for freedom and start becoming the slavery of external determination?
That is the dilemma of modern life. If I treat you like a child, if I hide information from you or restrict your physical movement, I can guarantee your safety. I can guarantee you won't crash. But I have technically deleted your autonomy. I've prioritized your survival over your humanity.
You've turned me into a sunflower. Unbounded, maybe. But reacting to your light, not my own choices.
Precisely. The trade-off is usually we sacrifice the Aristotelian self-rule in favor of the Lockean safety. We accept the external rule to avoid the crash. But we have to ask ourselves, in doing so, do we lose the very essence of what it means to be a free agent?
That is the question we're going to leave you with today. We want you to think about two competing goods, safety and self-determination. If you had to choose, would you rather be perfectly safe in a world where you don't know the whole truth, or would you rather have the dangerous, chaotic burden of knowing everything and deciding for yourself?
It's the difference between a well-kept garden and a wild forest. Which one are you?